So I put in the little Simon Singh example, just as I said, as a kind of fun illustration of how having a strong prior, even when you've got effectively noise, can wind up just giving you back your prior rather than any improvement on that in your posterior. What we want to look at is a situation where almost the opposite is true, where the problem becomes likelihood dominated. So I want to use this as an illustration of how in a Bayesian approach you can test your model and sort of update your posterior as you go along. So I'm going to take a simple example, and just to be really neutral and not involve any particular physics area, I'm just going to make it tossing a coin. So the setup here is described on this slide. We're going to look at the probability of obtaining a head or a tail. So that's the unknown parameter that we'd like to estimate. And if it's a fair coin, you would expect that to be 0.5, but it might not be a fair coin. And among the questions we want to think about are, well, how large a sample would you need to reliably measure that probability? So the model we use is a binomial distribution. So theta is the parameter. It's the probability of a head. We'll just denote that by a capital H from a single toss. And suppose you make n coin tosses and you get r heads. The probability of that is it's proportional to theta to the power r times 1 minus theta to the n minus r. So that's what we call the likelihood. And the likelihood times the prior is proportional to the posterior. So because it's a toy model problem and we want to control things so we can see how changing certain things influences the outcome, we're actually going to simulate some data rather than just sit there tossing coins for half an hour. So we do the simulation by choosing a true value for theta, and then we sample a uniform random number from 0 to 1. We'll look tomorrow at how you do that. And, well, quite simply, we set the cumulative distribution just to be theta itself. So the probability of x being less than theta is theta. So if we've sampled our uniform random number x, so let's say, for example, that we choose theta to be 0.5, that would be the case for a fair coin, then if our sampled value of x is less than 0.5, we say it's a head. If it's greater than 0.5, we say it's a tail. But you can do the same thing for different values of theta. So say theta was 0.25, then that means there's a 25% chance of getting a head. So if you sample a uniform number from 0 to 1, then 25% of the time, that number should be less than 0.25. And 75% of the time, it should be greater than 0.25. So that allows you to generate a sample with the right properties. So we're going to take theta to be 0.25, and we're going to look at how the posterior for theta evolves as we get more and more data. So we're going to consider two different priors. One is a flat prior, where all values of theta are equally probable. That's the red horizontal line. And then we're going to take a prior which is peaked at 0.5. So that might be appropriate if you sort of think, yeah, well, the coin's probably fair, but it might not be, so we'll allow some latitude in that, we'll allow some spread in the value of theta, but it's still centered on 0.5 and peaked there. So these are our two priors. And after tossing zero coins, of course, the posterior is just the prior. So the red and the green prior are shown here. And then we toss one coin and we get a head. So with the uniform prior, that becomes the posterior shown by the diagonal line. So it's very firmly peaked at theta equals 1. Remember, theta is the probability of getting a head. Well, we tossed the coin once and we got a head. So the posterior says that theta should be close to 1. In the case of the strong prior, well, we've only had one data point, so not surprisingly, the posterior still looks pretty much like what the prior did. It shifted a little, but it's prior dominated. Two coins tossed, and the second one's ahead as well. So that reinforces our posterior in favor of large values of theta, and it shifts the other posterior with the green prior, it shifts that a little bit further to the right as well. Then we get a tail, So that moves the posterior back a little bit towards lower values of theta in both cases. And then we get another tail, which means that we get, in fact, the red posterior is peaked at 0.5, but it's still quite broad. And the green posterior is also peaked at 0.5, and in fact, is slightly narrower than the prior, because the data has sort of reinforced the message that the prior had, which was we expect it to be peaked at 0.5. Then the next one is a tail, so that shifts the red posterior even further to the left and shifts the green posterior a little bit to the left as well. Then let's jump a few, it gets boring after a while. With 10 coins, 5 heads, 5 tails, again both posteriors are peaked at 0.5 because the data support that, an even split between heads and tails. And moreover, if we flip between 0 coins and 10 coins, you can see that the green posterior is now narrower than the green prior was, because our prior assumption has thus far been reinforced by the data we've obtained to date. 20 coins. Well, now there's a bit of a split emerging, because we've only got 7 heads and 13 tails. So that's what the two posteriors look like now. 50 coins. 100 coins, 200, 500. So the crucial point, really, the main message here, is that provided you have enough data, it becomes likelihood dominated. And even in, though we started with two very different priors here, the posterior is almost identical by the time you've got 500 data points. And after 1,000, that's even more true. And the maximum value of the posterior is very close to 0.25, which is the value that we assumed is the true value to begin with to generate the data in the first place. So what did we learn from all of this? Just a quick summary of that. As our data improves, as the sample size increases, the posterior narrows and becomes less sensitive to our choice of prior. And the posterior, therefore, conveys our degree of belief in different values of theta, and moreover, that can evolve. It can change as we add more and more data, as it should, because the information we have is changing. If, on the other hand, you don't want to draw a curve, but you just want to write that posterior as a single number, then, well, you can choose a variety of numbers, but a sensible one is probably the mean of the PDF, the posterior PDF, or its median, or quite commonly the mode, the peak. And in fact, if it's a symmetric PDF, like a Gaussian, then you'll generally find that those three are all the same. The mean, the median, the mode are all equal. You can use the variance of the posterior to assign an error for theta. And that also allows us to define something which we do a lot in the physical sciences, to define what we call a confidence interval. In fact, in Bayesian probability theory, these are more correctly termed credible intervals. Name doesn't really matter, it's just jargon. But it's to make the distinction between this definition and the one that one would use in a frequentist confidence interval, which I'll get to in just a few minutes. So the Bayesian credible intervals are very intuitive, they're very sort of straightforward. All you're saying is, if you got your posterior and you say chop off 2.5% from one end and 2.5% from the other, then it leaves a 95% region, which is defined by these two limiting values of theta, theta 1 and theta 2, and all you're really saying is that you're 95% sure that theta lies between theta 1 and theta 2, because Bayesian probability is just about a degree of belief. So you're 95% sure that's the extent of your degree of belief. Of course, you could have taken 68% or 90% or any value you like. And also, the confidence region is not unique, because you could, for example, if you'd wanted to, have knocked 1% off the left end and 4% off the other, and that would also give you a 95% credible region. it would be a different one. So most of the time in the physics literature, in defining credible regions, people take an equal percentage probability at either end. Often that's motivated by certain properties which such a credible region will have. Like, for example, again, if you've got a symmetrical distribution, then it's easy to show that the narrowest credible region will correspond to the case where you take an equal area of both ends. Okay? But if you don't have a symmetric distribution, then that won't necessarily be true. But it's just traditional, people usually take an equal amount of probability away from both ends. Tomorrow we'll look in considerable detail about how you do that, not just when you've got a single parameter, but when you've got multiple parameters, when you draw contours of probability, which are seen a lot in physical sciences applications. I just want to briefly contrast this now with frequentist confidence intervals. Now, the good news is that in very many situations, these are essentially equivalent. But there is a fundamental difference in how we really should think about frequentist confidence intervals. And I think it's worth just drawing that to your attention as another reminder that the frequentist framework is sort of not without its difficulties, because, again, you've got all of this baggage of thinking about a series of other observations that you didn't actually make, but the frequentist probabilities sort of assume that you did in order that you can define probability in the first place. So let's see what I'm on about here. It's similar to an example that is in Phil Gregory's book, page 512, if you want to have a look. So Xi is an independent and identically distributed sample of 10 numbers drawn from a normal population with mean mu and standard deviation sigma, variance sigma squared. So we assume that mu is unknown, but sigma equals 1. And X bar is the sample mean random variable, and it's got standard deviation. The theory tells us it should be sigma over root 10. That's about 0.32. So we can write down that the probability of mu minus 0.32 being less than x bar being less than mu plus 0.32, we can write that down as 0.68. Now, where the 0.68 is coming from is the fact that this is 1 sigma. So sigma is 0.32, so if you go 1 sigma one way and 1 sigma the other, then the total area you're enclosing is 68%. That's just almost by definition of the normal distribution. If you work out the area between the mean minus 1 sigma and the mean plus 1 sigma, you get 0.68. Here's the picture of that. Standard normal distribution, mean 0, standard deviation 1. So if you go to minus 1 and plus 1, the grey area is 0.32, well, not exactly, but, you know, to two decimal places, and the unshaded area is 0.68. Now, you can rearrange that first expression into this form. You can say that the probability that the sample mean random variable minus 0.32 is less than mu, which is less than x bar plus 0.32, is 0.68. So those two statements are mathematically equivalent. Now, you might say, so what's the big deal? It's because if you actually then go and measure some data, what you get is a sampled value of x bar, let's say it's 5.4. It is very tempting to just plug 5.4 into this expression. And then that would give you, if you could do that, that the probability of mu lying between 5.08 and 5.72 would also be 0.68. So this is a fairly subtle point. It's back to something I mentioned before about why the X bar here is a capital, but the X bar here is a small letter. This one was a random variable, whereas the one on this slide is an actual observed value, like the wave function collapsing. Again, to link it to the way that probability crops up in quantum physics. And that's very important, because it means that this statement here is just plain wrong. So can we simply write it? The answer is no. And, well, the question is, why is that wrong? And again, it's a subtlety which eludes a lot of people in a lot of scientific papers. You see this written wrongly in many cases. Now, in the end, you know, it's a sort of very esoteric point. It's quite abstract. It's maybe not all that important, but I do just want to emphasise it by way of underlining the need to really think carefully about what frequentist probability actually means. So I've got a pop quiz question to try and get us all thinking about it, and it's another one where I kind of actually do give the answer on the next slide anyway, so don't feel bad if you can't get this now, but just see what you make of it. What I'm saying is that we can't just write that last probability statement where we substitute in the value of x bar. And it's because mu is a fixed but unknown parameter, according to frequentist probability theory. So given that that's the case, which one of these four statements is true? Is it A, B, C, or D? So, it's very tempting to think it would be answer C, because after all, we've heard earlier today that probabilities always lie between 0 and 1. But actually, it's not that, and it's because mu isn't itself a random variable. This is why I said it was a little bit abstract. Mu is a fixed but unknown parameter. So we don't know what mu is, but it's a fixed number, so it's either in that range or it isn't. So the probability is actually 0 or 1. So tempting and all as answer C is, and that's why in an awful lot of the physical sciences literature, people will write statements like this. They really shouldn't, because the strict definition of a frequentist confidence interval doesn't allow them to do it. So let me try and explain why. So as I say, the answer is in fact D. So this is another one of the pop quiz questions you just kind of get for free. In the frequentist approach, the true mean mu is a fixed although unknown parameter. It either belongs to the interval or it doesn't. So really that's the probability we should be writing. So again, let me try and illustrate where that's coming from. Okay, so we started off with an expression that involved a random variable. That was true, that's fine, no problem there. And what that statement means in frequentist probability theory is that if you were to repeatedly draw a large number of samples of size n equals 10 from your normal distribution, you would expect that in 68% of these samples, the actual sampled mean would sandwich the true mean according to this inequality. So let's see if that's true. Well, here are 20 realizations of the 68% confidence interval. The true mean is 5. The sample mean slops around a bit. Sometimes it's less than 5, sometimes it's more. And the confidence interval that you construct either includes 5 or doesn't. So the probability is either 0 or 1 for any given one. But if you look at all 20 of them together, 13 of them include 5. And 7 of them don't, if I've counted right, I think I have. Well, that comes out at 65%. It's not too different from 68. Or we can do another example. This is 50 realizations of a 95% confidence interval. And here, there are 2 realizations that don't overlap the true mean, and there are 48 that do. So that gives you 96%. Which is quite close to 95%. So it's another situation where in any given sample, in any given realization, you're not actually going to hit the exact number that you want to. But the more samples you have, the closer you'll get to it. So we call this the coverage. It's essentially a measure, if you repeat the experiment a large number of times, of how many times the true parameter, in this case the mean, lies inside your confidence interval. So there's a little MathWorld from Mathematica illustration of this. I thought I'd put a link into it, but I'll put it on the MySuper website. You can have a look at it online, and you essentially just see for yourself that as you generate a whole bunch of random sequences, then sometimes the confidence interval overlaps the true parameter, and sometimes it doesn't. And the fraction of times that it does will generally be very close to the confidence level of that confidence interval, otherwise known as the coverage. In essence, what this means is that a frequentist confidence interval isn't really a statement about the parameter at all. It's a statement about a process. It's a statement about how often, if you repeat a process a large number of times, the result of that process will produce an interval which overlaps the true value of the parameter. Now that's still very useful to know, and certainly if the confidence interval is narrow, then that's giving you strong encouragement that the confidence interval is spanning a region of your parameter space that's very close to where the true parameters must be. But it's just another case of where it has to be used a bit carefully. And in fact, in particle physics, especially in particle physics, although a little bit in other fields as well, there's a lot of literature around this. There's a technique called the Feldman-Cousins method, which is a way of constructing these confidence intervals properly. Now, I would say that if you actually just go for a Bayesian credible region, then you don't need to mess around with all this thinking about coverage and repeating the process a large number of times. The Bayesian credible region is just a statement about your degree of belief that the parameters lie in this range. As I said, I think that's a bit more intuitive. So say the math world, oh no, I did put a link into it. I wonder if it will run. We'll just try it and see. Yeah, so what you see here is where we're going to change the random number seed, so that will just continually generate new samples, and well, maybe we'll reduce the confidence level a bit. Let's take it down to 0.7. So what we expect to happen is that as we run our simulation, we should expect that about 70% of the time the horizontal blue line will overlap the vertical, and about 30% of the time it won't. So if we just run that, so that's this number, the coverage, and you can see that it's not 70, but it's hovering around 70. And that's just a consequence of it being a finite sample. So strictly speaking, you'll only get the correct coverage if you have an infinite number of random trials, and that's of course a bit hard to engineer in practical terms. Like I said, I would say that the frequentist construction is a bit more elaborate. It's well-founded in very rigorous mathematical theory, but it's not quite, in my view, as intuitive as the Bayesian one. And I already made that point about the credible interval not being unique, but you can define, for example, the shortest one. So, just to wrap up the day, and it's been a long day, I'm sure we're all a bit tired, and I've not got much voice left, but I just want to go through a couple more examples of where we can do parameter estimation in a Bayesian way, and these are examples from generally from Phil's book, I think there's one also from Davinder Sivia's book, and I've got examples like these on the problem sheets. So talking to the PGT students, they've all got to do those problem sheets and hand them in. the people in the top masters. The super students don't need to, but if you want to take a look at the problem sheets, you're very welcome. So the first is a problem involving Poisson distributions, which can be relevant to a whole bunch of different physical sciences problems. And this is the model we use for the Poisson distribution. So we've got n observations, and we have a rate parameter r, which is sort of like how many detections we expect to have. So the probability that n discrete events will occur in time interval t, given a positive real-valued Poisson process with event rate r. So, you know, you run your experiment for a certain time, you expect to get r events, you actually get n, and this is the probability distribution that would relate r and n together. So if you take a single measurement of n events from Bayes' theorem, you can turn it round, and this becomes our likelihood, which is a posterior, which is that the posterior for the rate r, given that we had n events, we can write that as a prior for r times the likelihood divided by the evidence. In fact, that's just a proportionality constant, so we don't even need to work that out. We need to choose a prior for r. Well, we'll talk tomorrow about ways in which we can do that. I've mentioned already that there are very principled ideas to do with statistical mechanics and so on that can inform your choice of prior. There's one choice of prior called the Jeffries prior, which occurs a lot. So we could choose that, but just to keep it simple for today, because we haven't got into any of that stuff yet, we'll just take a uniform prior. And remember, as I've been saying with the example of the tossing a coin, provided you've got enough data, then your choice of prior shouldn't really matter that much anyway. So we do a bit of algebra. It's a bit late in the day to go through the details, so I'll just sort of skate over that. But basically what we're trying to do is to get a posterior for the rate parameter r given a number of counts n. And we can work out its mode, we can work out its median, we can work out a sigma. And here's what it looks like. So if we observe no events, then the rate parameter is very strongly peaked at a value of r equals 0. If you observe one event, then the rate parameter is peaked at 1. If you observe 10 events, the rate parameter is peaked at 10, but there's a significant spread. Now, the dotted and the solid lines are for the different priors. There really is a very strong difference in the if you observe 0 events, you're just basically getting back the prior. But what you're seeing here is that there's very, very little difference with the posterior for different priors. That's the Jeffries prior or the uniform prior, provided you've got a large number of observations. But let's make life slightly more complicated. Let's suppose that there's not just an event rate of background sources, but there's also a foreground. So the background's of known rate B, and you've got a foreground signal of unknown rate S. And the quantity R that we observe is actually the sum of those two. So because we're assuming the background rate is known, that does simplify the algebra a little bit. So again, you can read this in Phil's book if you're interested. It all comes down to this expression here. You do a bit more algebra, you work out what the normalization constant C is, and now we're ready to start writing down some posteriors. And to make things interesting, I've gone for applying this to some results that were published just over 4 years ago. It was from a dark matter experiment in the US, and it actually got quite a lot of coverage at the time on the BBC website. And I suppose, to be honest, I don't want to sound too cynical about this, but any story in the BBC science pages that is a sentence that ends in a question mark, the answer is almost certainly no. And I'm afraid it looks like that was the case here as well. But it was an interesting story at the time. And, there might be some people in the room that know more about this experiment than I do. But what I did was just to take their paper that was appeared in the archive just over 4 years ago and essentially to replicate a little bit of the data analysis that they did just using this simple Poisson model with a constant background and an unknown foreground. The important point to stress is that the predicted event rate, assuming no signal, looks like this. So even if R equals zero, or rather if S equals zero, that meaning the unknown rate, the rate of maybe, you know, the sort of interesting dark matter particle that you want to detect, even if S equals zero, there is a significant chance of getting several events. But of course, they're not the dark matter particles, they're the other ones. So the probability of observing two or more background events is about 20%. Or turn it round, what you really want to do is to get a posterior for S, given that you've observed two events. This is really the important one. The posterior does peak away from zero. That would mean you have a non-zero rate of dark matter particles. But there's also a 15% probability that S is still zero. In other words, all you've seen is background. So, you know, to be fair, the people that wrote the paper acknowledged all of that. It's another example of where the way it was picked up in the media put a rather unhealthy spin on the result, which I think, you know, the authors of the paper themselves probably were happy enough to go along with, but they weren't really pushing too hard for themselves. If only, you know, the media would do the statistics properly, but that's probably too much to ask, because the newspapers, the websites, they all want it to be just black and white, yes or no. You don't want posteriors and all that kind of stuff. One more example, just to illustrate a little bit about points about priors and the importance of priors. So this is another example that could be applicable in many different areas of physics or physical sciences, of fitting a spectral line. So you've got some kind of spectrometer, lab-based or stuck in a telescope, and you get a profile, and you want to fit the strength of that spectral line. So you've maybe got a theoretical model for the shape of the profile, some nice Gaussian shape like that, in which case the only parameter you're trying to fit is the amplitude. That makes it relatively easy, especially if the data are as good as this, but this isn't sadly the data, this is your model for what you expect the data to look like. So essentially what you're doing is taking a template like this and trying to fit it to these data. So what you've got to do is you've got to decide what the amplitude is based on fitting it. So you just do the same kind of thing, you fit the posterior for the amplitude given a prior and given a likelihood. The posterior is going to be sensitive to your choice of prior. Again, we'll look at these different prior choices tomorrow, but for a uniform, or this one I've mentioned called a Jeffries prior, there is a difference. But what we're looking at here on the right-hand side is stronger data. So that's data where the spectral line really does have a stronger amplitude, a higher amplitude. Again, I'm going through this pretty quickly, but hopefully you can see that. Again, it's maybe already kind of obvious that the peak is actually here. And you can see that the peak amplitude is, well, getting on for 3 millikelvin in the units adopted here. Whereas in this case, the peak is more like 5 millikelvin. So consequently, when you crank through the analysis and work out your posterior for what that amplitude is, you know, best fitting it to the data, when you've got a higher amplitude, it's less sensitive to what your prior is. It's more dominated by the data and less dominated by the prior. That's consistent with the message we saw in the Simon Singh video and in the example just after coffee. But what if you didn't know the frequency or the channel number? Instead of fixing it to be, I think it was 38, what if that itself is an unknown parameter? Well, what you can do is you can compute a marginal posterior for the channel number, and sure enough, you get a whopping big peak at 38, but you get some other peaks at other values. In other words, the data can't quite make up its mind whether the peak is here or maybe there's a peak here, or possibly there's even some peaks in here. Now let's face it, that's more like what real data would be like. So what do we do? Well, if you allow the channel number to be a free parameter, the thing is that that will also change the marginal posterior for the amplitude. But again, that's no surprise, because if there's a single peak and it's really there, then clearly it's got a much higher amplitude than a single peak which is there, or a single peak which is there. But who says there should only be one peak anyway? Surely a better way to analyze the problem is to allow the number of peaks itself to be a free parameter and let the data tell you how many peaks there are. We'll look at that tomorrow. There's a method called model selection, which has become very commonly used in Bayesian inference, which is very well set up to do exactly that sort of problem. Now, I would guess, looking at these data, that there's maybe evidence for two or three peaks. After that, it's probably just all noise. But why should you take my word for it? That's really a pretty subjective judgment. Sure, I did say this morning that posterior probabilities are subjective, but that's not the same as arbitrary. It should be possible to take these data and construct a model, an output of which will be to tell us how many lines there are in the data. Now, it doesn't mean that there's definitely five or definitely four, but it's essentially treating that as something you can have a degree of belief about as well. And why not? It could be that there's five lines, it could be that there's four. Maybe you're more sure of the first four and not so sure of the fifth, but you should be able to capture that within your Bayesian model as well. And we'll see tomorrow how to do that. So if any of you have got problems that you're working on, data analysis problems where maybe there's a certain number of features you're looking for and you're not quite sure how many, and the weaker ones, well, maybe they're just noise, maybe we're not sure, Bayesian inference is very well set up to deal with that sort of problem. And hopefully the examples we'll go through tomorrow will give you some insights that might help you to maybe revisit some of your own work in this manner. So the sort of final thing to say in all of this is really just that you might be thinking as a result that, you know, it's like some great battle between the forces of good and evil, and that there has to be an absolutely right answer. It's not quite that simple. I do think there's a very strong and growing body of opinion that favours the use of Bayesian inference methods. And it's mainly because one of the criticisms of the Bayesian approach is the following, is to say that, well, if you adopt a uniform prior, that means that this second term here is just a constant, then maximizing the posterior is the same as maximizing the likelihood, which is what a frequentist would do. So surely they're just the same. But the underlying principle is completely different, and often you shouldn't assume a uniform prior. Now it's true, as I said a few minutes ago, that if the data are good enough, it won't really matter what your prior is anyway. So another way of saying that is, if you've got good enough data, then the differences between a Bayesian analysis and a frequentist analysis become less important. But let's face it, in a lot of areas of physics, we're not dealing with good data. We're digging around in the noise. And that's where doing it right and adopting the correct prior and doing the best job you can to squeeze every ounce of information out of the data, but not more than you should, that all becomes very important. And that is where I think the Bayesian approaches are especially useful. I've put a few examples of what you might term fundamentalist views on my SUPA, mainly just for your amusement as much as anything else. For example, there's a paper by Andrew Gelman, who actually is a very highly respected, you know, Bayesian statistician, but for a conference that was held a few years ago, just really to kind of, you know, be devil's advocate, he was asked to write a paper which presented some objections to Bayesian statistics. So as he said, opening section, a Bayesian's attempt to see the other side. But there was a response paper by a chap called John Skilling, who is again very highly respected in the field, but either he had a bit of a sense of humour bypass, or else the joke was that he was being so fundamentalist, because his paper begins, "Why we must use Bayesian." Probability calculus, often called Bayesian, is not an option to be accepted, modified, or rejected at whim. So he's a really hardliner, or at least he presented himself that way in this paper. But maybe I'll leave you with, you know, the suggestion that I think we're still at an era where there's so much frequentist analysis around still that it is important to really try and understand both, to think carefully about their applicability, and I suppose above all, to always strive to have good enough data that the differences won't really matter too much. And here's a quote from a chap called Louis Lyons from Oxford, who's a well-known advocate of frequentist methods, actually. But again, you know, he's been inclined to be very even-handed and to try to see both sides. He says that Bayesians address the question everyone is interested in by using assumptions that no one believes. Not sure if that's true, but, you know, again, it was an attempt to be provocative. Frequentists use impeccable logic to deal with an issue of no interest to anyone. And what he's getting at there is the need to invoke all of these unobserved, imagined distributions, sampled time and time and time and time again, so that you can build up your sort of definition of frequentist probability. So who is right? I would say that a bit of fence-sitting is still probably called for when it comes to this question of Bayesian versus frequentist. But at the very least, it's quite good to do your analysis using different priors anyway, just to see what difference it makes. Because if your answer is still very sensitive to your choice of prior, then you need to go and get better data. Trouble is, that's expensive. So what physicists usually do is just sit around arguing about which prior to use. But really, what you should do is go and get better data.